usually means it's time to start. I guess we don't give out tardies here, so. Good to see everybody tonight. Thank you for being here for our Bible study. And we're continuing our study in the book of Acts, looking at Paul's second journey now. Having left from Antioch with Silas, he picks up Timothy as a companion and helper along the way, and then Luke also in Troas, and they come to Philippi, as we talked about Sunday morning, and they go down by the river, and there they meet Lydia and preach the gospel to her, and she and her household are baptized, and they're staying then at her house. As we open up our study for tonight in Acts chapter 16, and starting in verse 16. And we'll be studying the rest of Paul's time here in Philippi that's recorded in the book of Acts, and then we'll move on from here to Thessalonica. We're focusing on, besides just going through the text and all of that, we kind of are hitting on the theme, really, of the Waldron's book, which is Go Tell the Good News, which goes along with our theme of Seeking the Lost this year at Eastside. So we're focusing on the fact that what's happening here is the gospel is being taken by evangelists, preachers and teachers to parts unknown. Many people are being converted, and there are a lot of great lessons in this for us. So look out for those as we go through the text and think about how can I apply this, what can I learn from this as I go about seeking the lost myself. So we're in Acts chapter 16. If I can get that to go. The thing's not going. We're in Acts chapter 16, and let's start in verse 16. Again, they're in Philippi. It happened, as we went to prayer, that a certain slave girl possessed with the spirit of divination met us, who brought her masters much profit by fortune-telling. This girl followed Paul and us and cried out, saying, "These men are the servants of the Most High God, who proclaim to us the way of salvation." And this she did for many days. But Paul, greatly annoyed, turned and said to the Spirit, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her." And he came out that very hour. So Paul here casts out the spirit of divination out of this slave girl who was being used by certain unscrupulous individuals, charlatans, in the city of Philippi for the purpose of making money out of fortune-telling. I guess the first thing that comes to our minds about this is, well, could she actually foretell the future? And I think the answer to that is likely not. I don't see how that would be possible. Now, there's an interesting passage that Brother Waldron points out, and there are others that we might look at, but I'll note this since he mentioned it in the book in Isaiah chapter 41, verses 22 and 23, relating to the power of false gods. We understand from the New Testament, by the way, that idolatry was the work of demons, so the power that was behind false gods like idols was actually the demonic forces. You know, that was the doctrine of demons. So you have that connection in Isaiah chapter 41 and verse 22, when Isaiah says this about the idols: "Let them bring forth and show us what will happen. Let them show the former things what they were, that we may consider them, and the latter end of them, or declare to us the things to come. Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know that you are gods. Yes, do good or do evil, that we may be dismayed and see it together." I think the implication of that passage, at least, is that if somebody had true divine power, that they would be able to foretell the future. Demons don't have that. And so, you know, the force that's behind idolatry wouldn't have that. Wouldn't have that power. So I think that the biblical answer to the question is God can foretell the future. Satan can't do it. Demons can't do it. But as you think about what's being described here, could this slave girl know things that were not obvious to mere mortals? What do you get out of the context? Looks like she did. How does she know that these are the servants of the Most High God? How does she figure that out in preaching what they're preaching? I say she, it's the demon within her that's doing the speaking, I understand that. And so even when Jesus encountered people who were possessed by unclean spirits, anybody think of some things that they may have confessed or said that might not have been real obvious to somebody when Jesus just walking up? Yeah, more than once, you know, the idea that the demon knew who Jesus was, that repeatedly happens. He's the Christ, the Son of God, so on and so forth. And in fact, they realized that they were subject to him, that he could, remember, the man with the legion of demons realized that Jesus could cast them out or whatever he wanted to do. Don't send us into the abyss, he says. So the demons within these people who were possessed would have known some things about the spirit realm, especially been aware of some things that the average person walking the street wouldn't be able to. And I suppose, and this may be a little bit of conjecture, y'all can tell me what you think if you'd like, but I suppose that because they had that kind of knowledge of some things that average people wouldn't know about, that it would be pretty easy for them then to deceive people into thinking that they had some special power about, you know, telling the future or whatever it might be. And you can see how that might work. Anybody else have an idea or a thought along that line? I'm probably the only one who's thought about that, right? No, I'm not. All right. So, in any case, she is spirit-possessed, and Paul casts out the spirit. It says he's greatly annoyed. Why do you think he's annoyed? I mean, just besides the human factor here that somebody's going around saying this over and over and over again for days on end, you think that's a distraction to his preaching? No doubt, right? And so when we're preaching the gospel, when we're trying to share the gospel with others, I think one of the obvious things that we want to do is to avoid distractions. If we can get people listening and have their total attention, that's very, very important. Instead of being, you know, this is very simple, obviously. You don't go have a home Bible study with someone sitting in their living room with the TV on. You know, that's just not something that you want to do. That's just a distraction. So those kinds of things, I think, are just obvious and common sense. But because of Paul casting the spirit out of this girl, her master saw that their hope for profit was gone. They seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to the authorities. And so this would be the agora in Philippi, the common place where a lot of business was done. People would be gathered. Magistrates would typically be sitting in a place like this. It would, you know, be the place lots and lots of people would normally be there during the course of a day, sort of the center of the city's activities. So they dragged Paul and Silas into the marketplace to the authorities. They brought them to the magistrates and they said, "These men, being Jews, exceedingly trouble our city." Why do they call them Jews? That's, in their minds, that's what they were, right? Okay. This sort of identification of Christians in the Greco-Roman world was very common in the early part of the growth of Christianity and the spread of it throughout the Roman Empire, that people perceived followers of Christ as being a sect of Judaism. Even if they understood something about what Judaism was, they saw Christians as just a sect or a denomination within Judaism, if you will. And so they identify Paul and Silas with Judaism. They don't say that these guys are Christians, obviously. They connect them with Judaism. And The charge is they exceedingly trouble the city, teach customs which are not lawful for us being Romans to receive or observe. Well, what kind of customs would those be? What would be unlawful customs for Roman citizens to observe that Paul and Silas would be teaching folks? Anybody? Excuse me? True. So they were the law and the law enforcement of the area. I guess You know, the question is, how do the teachings of the apostles conflict with Roman law or culture? Yeah. Yeah. And essentially, if you didn't believe in the gods of the Romans, it didn't matter if you believed in some other god necessarily, but if you didn't believe their god, their label for you was atheist, essentially. So you think about how they would view that from their perspective. These people are completely abhorrent to our laws, our culture, what we believe, what we practice. And when we get to the next city, we'll see in Thessalonica that they bring up the charge of they're saying that there's a king besides Caesar, which is that may be part of what's being said here too, but it's vague enough that we don't know for sure. So anyway, they charge them with troubling the city and teaching unlawful customs. Now really, what's the real problem here? You know, the real problem is not the stated problem a lot of times. What's the real problem these guys have? Well, they've lost their profit. They've lost their cash cow, so to speak. And they're mad about that, and they're, you know, trying to get revenge for that. So that's really the problem. I don't think they much care about what they're teaching with respect to the religion. But they get everybody stirred up, and so the multitude rose up together against them. The magistrates tore off their clothes and commanded them to be beaten with rods. Can't hardly even imagine that sort of punishment. But everybody gets worked up into a frenzy, including the magistrates, by the account that, you know, they're just really, really incensed by what the charges are against these men. And it's worked up to this fever pitch, and the crowd is into it, the magistrates are into it, and they command them to be beaten with rods. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 25, Paul will later write, "Three times I was beaten with rods." Now, he was also multiple times stoned and at times left for dead. It's almost hard to imagine anybody going through any of that one time. And yet, just think about, you know, just somebody beating you with rods, caning you, essentially, like they might do still in China sometimes, still today, I think. And that's what they experienced. This persecution was from magistrates who were authorized by Rome, but it was really not, I don't think we could call it the beginning of Roman persecution. You know, Herod was also a king that was authorized by Rome who was persecuting the Jews already, I mean the Christians already in Jerusalem, as we saw in Acts 12. But here, I don't think it's really the beginning of what we might call empire-wide Roman persecution or something like that, but it is with the authority of Rome that these deeds are done to the evangelists in this case. So they're beaten with rods, and they throw them in jail, confined to stocks in the inner prison. It says, and they laid many stripes on them. I don't know how many is, but it's many. They threw them into prison, commanding the jailer to keep them securely. And having received such a charge, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in stocks. So that's about as, you know, basically in the inside of the jail, and what we might even call like a dungeon or something like that, and then put their feet in stocks besides that. So in his mind, they're not going anywhere, and I don't, you know, have to worry about that. In fact, I can go to sleep, is what he no doubt thinks. So he's got them securely taken care of. The text tells us that Paul and Silas are praying and singing at midnight. What's the attitude of Paul and Silas after receiving this kind of very brutal persecution for evangelizing? What's their attitude? They're ready to give up, sound like, or they're taking it out on God? They're praising God. Yeah. They're as Jesus instructed, and we read about in other places, rejoicing that they're counted worthy, as Peter, instead of Peter and the others in earlier in Acts, rejoicing that they're counted worthy to suffer for the cause of Christ, taking their persecution joyfully. also interesting, just maybe a sidebar here, you might say, that they're praying and they're singing hymns, and the prisoners were listening. It's just not that the prisoners heard. The word here is a little stronger than that. The prisoners were listening to them. People are listening to us. Some people like to sing, you know, when they're working and things like that. When you sing a hymn or a song of praise, when you're, say, at work doing something, as you're kind of fiddling around or something, you have that on your mind, you sing that hymn of praise, people listen to that sort of thing. People listen. People are aware when, you know, you say your prayer before your food. You don't do that to be seen of men, but people listen. This wasn't done to be seen of men, but it was helping men who were hearing, were listening to the praying and the singing. Nobody else ran out. Yeah, could be. But I do think it's interesting as far as, again, applying this to our lives today and trying to be evangelists and spread the gospel and seek the lost. Making praising God, no matter what happens in your lives, no matter what difficulty you're going through, making praising God part of your lifestyle, I think influences people. I know it does. And it can be a good way, just a good part of your efforts to seek the lost. Yeah. Right. And that's important in this story to understand that if he lost these prisoners, having received such a charge, if he did lose one of them to escaping, that would be his life. In fact, we've already seen that, haven't we? Because when Peter escaped prison in Acts chapter 12, what did Herod do to those guards? He ordered them to be put to death. So we've already seen that in the book of Acts, and that was, I gather, the common practice if a jailer received a charge to keep somebody securely. Let me read the rest of the text here. Suddenly there was this great earthquake. The foundation of the prisons were shaken. Immediately all the doors were open. Everyone's chains were loose. So everybody was free. And, you know, as Jeff pointed out, nobody escaped. Implication is they could have. But their chains were all loose. The keeper of the prison now is waking from sleep. He sees the prison doors open. He thinks, oh, everybody's gone. So he draws his sword to kill himself. And I guess the idea is I'd rather kill myself than have my head chopped off or be crucified or whatever he might have to endure. It probably wouldn't be crucifixion if he's a Roman citizen, but nonetheless, it would be some probably horrible death, and he'd just rather kill himself than endure that. So Paul cries out with a loud voice, "Do yourself no harm, for we are all here." We're all here. He called for a light. The jailer calls for the light. And you see this very intense moment, no doubt, all of this very intense from an emotional standpoint, I think. And he comes in, he falls down trembling before Paul and Silas. He's trembling. He's just been within that close of taking his own life. Right before that, he thought he lost everybody, all of this, you know, his prisoners, and then he almost took his life. And now he comes in and he's literally shaking. And he just falls down before Paul and Silas. He's a person that's in a pretty good state as far as if you want to evangelize somebody. Again, just a little tip here. If somebody's just had a near brush with death, that's a good time to talk to them about Jesus. might point that out to you. And that's why, frankly, people in hospitals, they don't mind. I found over the years, they don't mind if you come in and talk about the Lord to them or even the condition of their life a lot of times. Folks appreciate that. They're thinking about those kinds of things. And that is a good time to talk to people. But this man was certainly ready to hear. He brings them out and he says, "What must I do to be saved?" And obviously he's not talking about being saved from, you know, being killed, because that's not going to happen. Nobody's escaped. That's not his concern. I think he has a spiritual concern at this point. Others may disagree, but I believe that's what he's thinking about, is spiritual salvation. So Paul responds in this way, and he says, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and you will be saved, you and your household. And they spoke the word of the Lord to him and all who were in his house. We don't need to pretend like verse 31 is the entirety of Paul's message. It is not, and it cannot be the entirety of Paul's message. I think a lot of religious people today think, well, that's the entirety of the message that you need to share with somebody to bring them to Christ. Just believe. Isn't that kind of it? Isn't that what people today would say? Well, what do you need to do to bring somebody to Christ? Just tell them to believe on Jesus. And that's all there is to it. Well, it wasn't all there was to it here. It never is all there is to it in the book of Acts. There's always more teaching, speaking the word of the Lord. You think of the case of the Ethiopian eunuch, and Philip, you know, begins at a place talking about Jesus and tells them about Jesus and gets them to the point where he's baptized. You think about what Peter said to the Jews in Acts chapter 2 and other sermons that we've already seen in the book of Acts. So you look at this. He says, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and you will be saved, you and your household. Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him and all who are in his house. So they said a lot more than just believe. And when they get done with that, they took him the same hour of the night and washed their stripes, and immediately he and all his family were baptized. How'd they find out about baptism? That must have been some of the word of the Lord that was spoken to them, right? So it's more than just believing. There's some response that's necessary. So what you see is, in response, the jailer washed their stripes. That indicate maybe some repentance on his part. He's no longer, you know, they're going along with their persecution. He's going to ease the wounds that maybe even he had had, you know, a lack of concern of before. Now he's concerned about that. He's baptized. He sees Paul and Silas. And as it goes on, when they brought him into his house, he set food before them. He rejoiced, having believed in God with all his household. He believed in God prior to his baptism, obviously. So all of that goes right in line with what we've learned already in case after case in the book of Acts. The gospel is preached. It's preached that Jesus Christ, he's king, his life, his death, his burial, his resurrection, and then salvation by believing in him, repenting of sins, being baptized for the remission of sins. That's the common story that we've seen throughout these early chapters in Acts as far as bringing somebody to Christ. Of course, that's the message that we need to share today. Yes? One of the things I wanted to point out in this text is Paul and Silas, at the end of this, having taught this household, and again, it's not just the jailer, but it's the whole household, they go back into prison. And that's a little bit interesting. The jailer didn't have authority from the standpoint of the magistrates, obviously, to let them go as yet. So Paul and Silas go back into prison and apparently do that, you know, willingly. I don't know if to accommodate the jailer. I don't know. We're not told exactly what goes on there. But the next day finds them in prison. But the magistrates send officers to release them with instructions to set them free. Verse 35. In verse 36, the keeper of the prison reported to Paul that, you know, they sent to let you go, so therefore depart and go in peace. But Paul responds to that, and basically says, no, we're not going. We're not going in peace. We're going to raise an objection to this kind of treatment. He says, first of all, that they have beaten us openly, uncondemned Romans. So the idea of being beaten openly, you know, in almost what was almost a mob scene, is certainly not justice, you know, in the way that we treated the day before. They were uncondemned Romans, and that's an even bigger problem, because they had Roman citizenship, and Roman citizens had some real rights when it came to the way they were treated in the empire by Roman governing officials. And those had been severely violated by the events of the preceding day. Now, no doubt, these magistrates thought they were just dealing with Jews and not with Roman citizens. But, you know, Paul was a Roman citizen, and since he uses the plural, you assume Silas may have been too somehow. Not sure about how that might have been, but it's very possible he was, because the text says he was, a Roman citizen as well. So the magistrates are in trouble, just frankly. I mean, just something like this gets up to higher authorities in Rome, or gets back to Rome that they've done this, and, you know, their goose would be cooked. So Paul is calling that to their attention. They've been thrown into prison, which they didn't deserve, being, again, Romans that weren't tried properly. And now the magistrates want to release them secretly. Just, in other words, the magistrates probably realize, well, we've gone overboard here, so we'll just kind of, you know, get them out of town. Paul says no. Besides the fact that maybe he's a little bit, let's just say he's put out by the way he's been treated, what other motivation might Paul have here for insisting that these magistrates realize what they've done and be called to, you know, apologize for it and all that? What else might be motivating him? Yeah, he wouldn't want to support their lie or their deception, which they were trying to sweep it all under the carpet. What about the future of the church in Philippi? How would what he does here affect it? Could you see, if this was allowed to stand as is, then, you know, Paul's going to leave town, and the magistrates might feel free to treat the remaining Christians in the city the same way, if similar charges are brought against them. So I think in doing this, he sort of is ensuring that the remaining Christians in Philippi are going to be left in peace, probably, by these magistrates. And nobody's going to drag anybody else before them. You know, these Jews are troubling the city, teaching this stuff, and the magistrates are not going to make this mistake twice. So I think that maybe part of his motivation here, hard to say what effect it might have had, but certainly Paul does cause them to think about their deeds and what they've done, and they come and they do apologize, and they plead with him to depart from the city. So after he stops by the house of Lydia, then that's what they do. They came and brought him out, pleaded with them, and brought them out and asked them to depart from the city. And they went out of the prison into the house of Lydia. When they seen the brethren, they encouraged them and departed. So that brings us to traveling on, now leaving Luke here in Philippi, and traveling on through Amphipolis and Apollonia to come to Thessalonica in 17 and verse 1. They passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia. The indication is they may not have preached there, or at least we're not told that they did, but they came to Thessalonica, where there's a synagogue of the Jews. They may have been looking for a synagogue of the Jews to begin, you know, work in a place that would have a solid footing. So they wind up in Thessalonica. Interesting, I don't know how many of us have thought about this, but Luke is left in Philippi for some long time. That might account for a number of things, like the strength of the church in Philippi, which by what we can tell was a very strong group for some long time, located there and supportive of Paul and in his future work and all of that sort of thing. And certainly Luke, ultimately being an inspired man, writing two books of the New Testament, would have been a huge asset to the church at Philippi for the time that he was there. We're not told anything about you know, any work that he did there, but that would be, I think, a good assumption. Here's the area of the world that we're looking at. Here's Philippi. This is the Ignatian Way that we mentioned Sunday morning, this Roman road that goes all the way across the north coast of the Aegean on over to the Adriatic. But here's Philippi, and they're going along this road through Amphipolis and Apollonia to Thessalonica. This is that, again, that same road. This would be, if they turned around as they were leaving Philippi, sort of the view they'd have back toward the sea at that point. Just kind of imagine walking down the road with them to go to further on their journey. So they come to Thessalonica, and 17 and verse 2, Paul, as was his custom, went into them, this synagogue that they found here, for three Sabbaths, reasoned with them from the Scriptures. So this was always his first move. If he goes into a city, he finds Jews that are there, like he did even in Philippi when they didn't have a synagogue. He went down to the river and found worshipers of God. And here he goes straight to the synagogue, starts with the Jews, and they have a lot of common ground. And that's, again, a lesson in evangelism, isn't it? You've got common ground with somebody. We've got a lot of common ground with our friends and neighbors in this part of the world, usually Bible believers, usually believers in God, usually already believing and that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. That's a lot of common ground with a lot of folks that we would come in contact with. Not everybody, but a lot of common ground. So it's a great place to start with people you have common ground with. They had this common faith in the God of the Old Testament, an understanding of the Old Testament law, and the prophets. And Paul will use the Old Testament scriptures. You think about what's said here. He reasoned with them from the scriptures. So he's quoting or referring to Old Testament passages, and there's lots of them that talk about the coming Christ and the setting up of the kingdom and the establishment of the church. And so he's talking about all those kinds of things and that the Christ would suffer and that Christ would die and so on and so forth. And so he's bringing all of that to their attention from the Old Testament scriptures, as has been done in previous sermons in the book of Acts. He's explaining and demonstrating that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, saying this Jesus whom I preach to you is the Christ. Now, just a note here, Christ is the Greek term for what? Hebrew-based term. Messiah, right? The Jews are looking for the Messiah. And that's basically the Hebrew word. And Christ is the Greek word, but they mean the same thing, the anointed one, the anointed one. So when he says, when Luke says, Paul is showing them that he's the Christ, that Jesus is the Christ. He's saying Jesus is the Messiah, this one that's talked about, the anointed one that's talked about in Old Testament prophecy. While he's in Thessalonica, interestingly, he receives support from the church in Philippi. That's mentioned in Philippians chapter 4, so the people in Philippi, you think about Lydia, they've just left her house and she might send a messenger on or something. The church as a whole apparently sent help to support Paul in the work that he's doing in Thessalonica there and even beyond that. Philippi is going to be an important supporter of Paul going forward. I think we mentioned that Sunday morning. But what happens in Thessalonica? There's a lot of success initially. There are people that are persuaded in verse 4, a great multitude of devout Greeks, not a few of the leading women join Paul and Silas. So these would be Hellenistic Jews, I think, he's preaching in the synagogue. A lot of the leading women there, again, these would be Jews in Greco-Roman culture. Their situations would be different from the Jews that most of the Jews in Jerusalem. But there were Jews in verse 5 who were not persuaded. They became envious and took some of the evil men from the marketplace. Again, you go to the Agora, you find some bad guys that are looking to get in trouble, and you recruit them. And they gathered a mob, and they set all the city in an uproar, and attacked the house of Jason. Apparently, they'd been staying with this Jason. And they sought to bring them out to the people. When they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some brethren to the rulers of the city, crying out, "These who have turned the world upside down have come here too." Jason has harbored them These all are acting contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another King Jesus. So now the charge is more serious in Thessalonica, and also a little bit more accurate when you think about it. It's really the same thing. As I was reading this and studying this, we all agree it's a lot like what the Jews did when Jesus was crucified. A lot of the same kind of approach to trying to get these people in trouble. Well, he's claiming to be a king, contrary to Caesar. Of course, that's what they accused Christ of to begin with at his crucifixion. So it's the same sort of rationale that causes them to get things all stirred up. What do you think about the phrase, they've turned the world upside down? Right. Right. From their viewpoint, they've created total upheaval. And that, again, is sort of something we need to understand as spreaders of the gospel, as evangelists. We're going to make ripples, folks. I mean, just count on it. And people whose, you know, religions are steeped in their, you know, family traditions or whatever it might be, and they see the world through a certain prism, and this is how it's supposed to be, and you come along with the truth of the gospel and shake that up in some way or another, they're going to view you as a troublemaker. And I'm just going to be blunt. I think I have a lot of my brethren who don't want to be seen as troublemakers at all costs, including the cost of compromising the truth. We're afraid that denominational people or people in the world are going to see us as turning the world upside down. Well, guess what? That kind of goes with the territory. We are turning the world upside down, their world. So, you know, I think I've just seen a whole lot of, among even brethren, a willingness to compromise, to water down the message, to not make some points of the gospel, not make them as clearly as we should, just in an effort not to make as many ripples. And we want to be persuasive. We don't want to make people mad on purpose or whatever, but you're going to make ripples if you teach the truth, and probably going to make waves. In any case, they don't find Paul and Silas and Timothy. The mob doesn't. They're able to escape this. They take security from Jason. They release him, and then the brethren send Paul and Silas on to Berea, which is where we'll find them Sunday morning when we, Lord willing, of our class Sunday morning. Interesting thing here at Thessalonica, I'll just throw this in at the end. The phrase rulers of the city, as it's found in the New King James Version here, verses 5 and 6, is translated from a Greek word politarchus, or politarchs, and it only occurs here in Acts 17 in verse 6 and verse 8. A lot of years, students of history and of the Greco-Roman world claimed that Luke was inaccurate, that the Bible was not right here, because he used the title politarchs of city officials in Thessalonica, which they said was not used of the leaders of the city during this time period in this place. And so that was supposed to be plainly the Bible's wrong, you know. Plainly Luke got this wrong, as people have accused him in other places of as well. So this little inscription right here, which comes from a first century Roman arch at Thessalonica, begins, the first part of it says, in the time of the politarchs. So sort of written in stone that Luke was right and other guys were not right. That happens. That sort of thing happens with an amazing amount of frequency when it comes to archaeology actually confirming the Bible text rather than what the scholars sometimes, or the liberal scholars, would like it to say. All right. Other thoughts or questions before we end tonight? Seems like everybody's a little tired tonight, but thank you for trying to follow. I was not all that smooth this evening, but maybe we got something out of that. All right. Appreciate your help tonight.